From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Half a Revolution, journalist Masha Gessen has just edited a new collection of women's writing that emerged during Glasnost. We also talk with Gessen about covering the Chechen War. Then poet Lee Young Lee recalls his family's privileged Chinese ancestry and the circumstances that landed his family in a small town in Pennsylvania. It's the subject of his new memoir, The Winged Seed. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews three soundtracks that stand on their own. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress today the dollar's sharp decline has been unwelcome and troublesome. He's blamed part of the drop on the huge budget deficit. The dollar has staged a modest recovery in late afternoon trading in New York. Greenspan didn't say anything about a possible interest rate increase by the Federal Reserve. He had hinted 2 weeks ago that the Fed could be through with hiking interest rates, and adding that the central bank could ease them in the future. Those comments had been widely cited as contributing to the dollar's decline by critics. Attorneys for the trader who broke the largest merchant bank in Britain want the British government to make an extradition request for him. Trader Nick Leeson is being held in Germany on an arrest warrant from Singapore. NPR's Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The British and German lawyers representing the 28-year-old trader say it will be difficult to fight the extradition request from Singapore. Attorney Eberhard Kempf told journalists last week Leeson will fight the extradition request because he doesn't expect a fair trial. Singapore has accused Leeson of forgery and fraud in his financial dealings. The trader's lawyers say he would consider cooperating with British officials investigating the collapse of Barings Bank if Britain asks for Leeson's extradition. So far, British officials have said they will not compete with Singapore for extradition. British lawyer Stephen Pollard visited Leeson in prison and says his client is still in remarkably good spirits and has retained a sense of humor. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher has met with Egypt's foreign minister in Cairo talks today. He's preparing for a meeting tomorrow with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. NPR Suni Khaled reports from Cairo.
A senior State Department official said Secretary Christopher got off to a good start during initial discussions with Egyptian foreign ministry officials. Christopher met for an hour with Egyptian Foreign Minister Amr Moussa. The two discussed strained Egyptian-Israeli relations over the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Emerging from the talks, Foreign Minister Moussa said that failure to make progress on Israel's refusal to sign the treaty and open its nuclear program to international inspections would not augur well for discussions on other matters. Christopher meets with President Mubarak tomorrow before flying to Israel in the afternoon to begin discussions there on breaking the deadlock in talks with the Palestinians on autonomy for the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
North Korea is warning the United States that a landmark nuclear accord is under threat. Pyongyang wants Washington and its allies to stop trying to force the North to accept South Korean light water nuclear reactors. The warning came in a statement released by the North Koreans today in Geneva, Switzerland. It says the North has nothing to lose or to fear if the accord is broken. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 20 points at 3,982. Trading is heavy. This is NPR News. President Clinton has signed an executive order barring the federal government from doing business with firms that hire permanent replacement workers for strikers. The order affects federal contracts worth more than $100,000, and it's effective immediately. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich will be responsible for implementing the order. The White House says the dispute at Bridgestone Tire Company could be examined by Reich under this order. The move faces very stiff opposition from congressional Republicans. The Seattle school bus strike is in its second day. Talks between striking drivers and the school bus company are stalled. The walkout has affected about 13,000 school children. Caroline Leary of member station KPLU reports.
For now, both sides are telling their side of the story to the media and on the picket lines. A federal mediator has been called to help find common ground between the two parties. Striking drivers have been picketing the Laidlaw Bus Company's offices in Seattle since early this morning. The drivers are demanding a pension plan, but so far the Laidlaw Company has refused, saying they don't want to provide benefits for what they consider to be part-time workers. Absentee rates at many elementary schools are high. On the first day of the strike, nearly 2,000 students missed school. The school district is trying to help parents find alternative transportation. They have set up a hotline and are providing free bus tokens to middle and high school students. For National Public Radio, I'm Caroline Leary in Seattle.
U.S. officials in Pakistan are expressing anger over today's ambush of three U.S. consulate workers in Karachi. Two were killed, a third was wounded. Officials have released a formal statement denouncing the attack and saying they don't know why it happened. The three were shot while being driven to work in a van. No one's claimed responsibility for the attack. The Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has sent a letter of condolence to President Clinton and vowed to find those responsible. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moskowain. Russia has a celebrated and historic literary tradition marked by such important figures as Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, and Solzhenitsyn. Journalist Masha Gessen says that an important voice has been excluded from publication in Russia, women. Women have rarely been published, forcing them to share their work informally, even secretly. Glasnost changed all that, and the last few years have seen an emergence of women writers. Gessen has edited and translated a new collection of short stories by contemporary Russian women called Half a Revolution. Masha Gessen was born in Moscow and emigrated to the States in 1981 at the age of 14. Last year, she decided to make Russia her home again. Masha Gessen covers education and policy issues in Eastern Europe for Lingua Franca and for the New Republic. She covered the war in Chechnya for the Russian magazine New Times and for the British publication The New Statesman and Society. In the mid-80s, all kinds of writing surfaced because of glasnost. But Gessen says glasnost was especially good for women.
Women's writing as a distinct kind of writing really only emerged during glasnost. No one had ever looked at Russian literature and said that it could be divided into women's fiction or women's poetry and men's writing. That's something that really only showed up during perestroika, during glasnost. So I think that it was incredibly good for women writers, first of all, because a lot of them, just like their peers who are men, got a chance to be published for the first time. But also it was good for women writers because it allowed them for the first time an opportunity to see themselves as a distinct group of writers.
Well, what would you say is distinctive about the voice of the women writers that have emerged since glasnost?
Well, the Russian society is incredibly gender differentiated. It's very, very rigid in terms of gender lines. And so the view of women on the world is quite different from the view of men. I mean, we're talking a repressive patriarchal society. We're also talking about women who have seen the few social security structures and the few rights that they had in that society completely collapse and slip away from them during perestroika.
Let me ask you about Yelena Tarasova. Mm-hmm. And the story you've included in this anthology is called She Who Bears No Ill. You say this is one of the most, or I guess others have said, this is one of the most dangerous pieces of fiction ever written. And that's a quote. Why is she so controversial? And what is so controversial about this particular story?
Well, I think to an American reader, that might really be surprising that the story is so controversial. One of the reasons it's so controversial is because it's very graphic. The narrator of the story is a woman with this mysterious degenerative disease that Tarasova has invented. And she goes into some detail about the way this disease has disfigured her body, has deformed her, and has changed her life. Russian fiction, or at least in the Soviet period, was incredibly polite and very, very clean. And this is not a clean story. This is not a polite story. This is a very sort of in-your-face story. I think to Russian readers that was shocking. It's ironic in the society where you can walk out into the street and see just absolutely most horrifying things. And at this point, you can walk out into the street of the city of Grozny and see people lying around with their legs cut off.
From the war. Mm-hmm.
From the war. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, people are not do not expect to open up a journal or a book and read about something that is distasteful.
Well, then, as a writer who's written this shocking piece of fiction, is Yelena Tarasova someone read by Russian people? Is it difficult for her to find a publisher?
It was very difficult for her to find a publisher for this particular piece, which is actually her first piece, and of course, as a controversial piece of writing, her best known piece. She's not published very widely. I see her pieces show up, but mostly in women's writing anthologies.
One thing I noticed looking through the stories that you have collected and compiled is that many of the stories are told in the first person, and I was curious whether you think there's something very Russian about that, or if you think there's something very female about that.
I think it's both. There has definitely been a rise in the number of stories we see written in the first person, again, especially since Glasnost and Perestroika, but also the whole sort of fiction movement that emerged in the 1970s was largely autobiographical and confessional. I think this was necessary because Soviet fiction was required to be about people that none of us knew and none of us could even imagine. There were these mythical characters who led these very strange lives that were like nothing that any of us had ever seen. But they were like this fiction of Soviet reality that had been created for all of us. So I think that one way of counteracting that was for writers to begin writing in the first person about things they really knew.
Well, let me ask you about what then life is like today for Russian women. And one thing I was reading is that the majority of people unemployed in Russia are women. Something like 70% are women.
That's true. That's one of the great sad and depressing paradoxes of what has happened. The Soviet Union nominally was a gender-equal society. It was a society in which women had all the same rights as men. This was never really true, but women did work like everybody else. Women did have jobs. They were not there was the same glass ceiling that we're used to thinking about here. So women never moved up in their careers as much as men did. But at least they had jobs. And also there were quota systems. For example, in the Supreme Soviet, 30% of the deputies were women. This was required by the quota system. After Perestroika, when the election system was freed up, the number of women in parliament and in various local representative legislative organs dropped to between 2 and 8% from 30.
From 30%,
right? Mm-hmm. The largest group of people who are suffering from the layoffs that are resulting from the conversion to a market economy and the economic depression that the country is experiencing are women. I think the statistic is 80%. Of the women between the ages of 25 and 40 are now unemployed.
Why, though, are women bearing, I guess, the brunt of the change, the economic change, and the economic problems in Russia?
Well, it's a society that has always seen women as disposable. It's a society that has seen people as disposable, but women even more so than men. So when when managers are faced with the question of who they dispose of first, of course they dispose of women.
Are there any women's rights organization, feminist organizations in Russia that can kind of plead the plight of women?
There is a burgeoning women's movement in Russia. The word feminist continues to be a very tricky word. It was declared a bourgeois anachronism by the communists, and it's still perceived almost like as a swear word by a lot of women. But there are some feminist organizations. In fact, the woman who wrote the introduction to the book, Olga Lipovska, we call her the grandmother of Russian feminism. She is somebody who founded the first feminist journal and then one of the first feminist organizations. So there are, I would say, probably several hundred, 2,000 women who identify strongly as feminists and work very actively in feminist organizations around the country. There are many, many more who work in various women's organizations that are feminist in the way that people understand the word in the West, and who are working to create some new social security systems for women, who are working to combat the issue of unemployment, which is probably the most pressing issue for women right now. And then there's the soldiers' mothers movement, which is coming to the forefront now with the war going on. That's probably the largest unofficial, that is non-government sanctioned, women's organization in the country and the most active.
Well, I want to talk some more, and I want to talk actually about the work you've done in Chechnya, which I know that you have covered as a journalist. But first, we have to take a very short break. And my guest is Masha Gessen, and she's a journalist, writes about education and policy issues in Eastern Europe for Lingua Franca. She also writes for The New Republic, and she's just edited a collection of short stories by contemporary Russian women writers called Half a Revolution. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Masha Gessen. You've been covering the war in Chechnya for Russian magazine and also for a magazine in England as well. When was the last time you were there?
I was there in late January.
And how close to the fighting were you able to get?
I was right there.
Okay, so were you in Grozny?
Yes.
Okay. Describe for us, if you can, and this is you know, 6 weeks ago or so, but what you saw in Grozny?
Well, I don't think, unfortunately, it has changed a lot in the last 6 weeks. I think what people can see in Grozny and around Grozny now is exactly the same thing, just more of it. What I saw were civilians, most of them elderly women, some of them children, most of them, incidentally, ethnic Russians, who were just sitting targets. They were sitting there and they were being shelled by the federal troops and they were waiting to die. There's this idea that the Russian federal troops are killing civilians by accident because they're so inept, they're so incompetent, these stray shells go and kill civilians. I saw them targeting objects of civilian life. I saw them targeting people. I saw them killing people on target.
Describe what you saw to us. And is it soldiers with rifles, or is it aiming something bigger than that?
Oh, no. The smallest thing that I saw being used against the civilian population is a large caliber machine gun bullet, which is, let's see, about 6 inches long and about 3 inches in diameter. That is the smallest thing. I tell you, it's ridiculous because journalists, when they go to war zones, put on bulletproof vests and helmets to make themselves feel more secure or something. And you run around this place, and there are literally people in the road with their legs cut off above the knee, some of them still alive, and their legs aren't lying next to them on the road. They're just gone. They're pulverized. That's the kind of weapons they're using against the civilian population. I saw shells that were bigger than I was.
Did you interview members of the Russian federal troops or officers or soldiers?
I was able to have casual conversations with them. I wasn't able to interview them, really, because access for journalists to the Russian federal troops is virtually closed. Unless you want to come in from the other side and just speak to the federal troops and just spend time in their camp.
So what did they tell you in their casual conversations?
Well, one of the things they did was they asked for information. They really did not know what was going on. These are just soldiers, some of them junior officers, who had been brought there. They hadn't been told where they were being taken. They were just brought and dropped in Chechnya to guard some post or to wait to be sent somewhere. And they had no idea what was going on. There was one time when I was talking to some border guard troops who were stationed near a large village on the border of Chechnya in the neighboring republic, Ingushetia. And they had been shelling that village that day. And I had been there just the day before and talked to the people who lived there. And I asked them, I said, do you know that this village is an ethnic Russian village? They said, no, it's not. It's a Chechen village. Hmm. And there are Chechen armed gangs there. And I said, no, they're not. They're old Russian people there. Go look.
Did they?
No.
So what happened to that village?
I think it's been completely destroyed. That's what I hear.
There has not been the kind of news coverage in the States in the last couple of weeks of Chechnya as there was back in January and the end of December. Does that mean that the fighting has decreased at all?
No, that's not what it means. It means that the American media has a very short attention span.
What's at the root, then, of this war? And clearly, certainly under Stalin, the people living in Chechnya were persecuted. Many people died under the Stalin regime. Is that what is at the basis of this war?
Well, I think what's at the basis of this war are individual ambitions of people in power. I think that President Yeltsin, who saw his ratings slipping catastrophically, wanted to wage a short, victorious war so that he could have a boost in popularity. And, of course, he chose the ethnic group that is least popular with Russians right now, or so he thought. He really had every reason to expect that what would happen would be the same thing that happened in the late 19th and early 20th century with the anti-Jewish pogroms, when the popular sentiment somehow was that if you killed the more Jews you killed, the better it was for Russia, and that killing Jews was tantamount to saving Russia. And the Chechens are an incredibly despised ethnic group.
Why?
Well, it's a dark people, which is always convenient, and they came from a republic that was rebellious. It had declared its sovereignty. Its sovereignty was really, and they're Muslim for what it's worth, although it is a perfectly secular society, but the culture is Muslim. The sovereignty that Chechnya declared was purely symbolic. What they were suggesting, what they were proposing to the Russian federal government, was that they would guard, they would have joint borders, they would have a joint currency, they would have joint external borders and transparent internal borders, and that simply that Chechnya would receive the profits from the very small amount of oil that is processed there that is also found there. That is all that Chechen sovereignty was about. It was about having a flag and a national anthem.
You mentioned earlier that mothers are going and taking their sons home from this war. Is that based in part on some of the stories that they've been able to glean from the Russian media about this war?
I think it's based more on word of mouth, although some of it is based in the press. It was reported in the press, and this is true, that the Chechen alderman directed the Chechen fighters to release all prisoners of war whose mothers come to pick them up. So a lot of the journalists have been bringing out letters from prisoners. The Chechens have been very good about allowing journalists to meet with federal prisoners. And so a lot of the journalists have been bringing out notes that read literally, "Mommy, please come and get me out of prisoner camp." And so these mothers come. They come in train loads.
How potent do you think this will become? I mean, do you see these mothers as a kind of challenge to the current government?
I think they very well may become. I actually see the Soldiers' Mothers Movement as probably the most potent social movement in Russia right now. One of the things they're planning to do is they're planning to sabotage the spring draft drive, and I think they very well may succeed.
How big would you say then this mother's movement is? Is there any way for you as a journalist to gauge its power, its momentum, its support?
I think it's a large grassroots movement that includes a lot of women who are active. What's even more important is that it has incredible grassroots appeal. In a country where there has been a draft for as long as anyone can remember, and where serving in the military, even in peacetime, has been incredibly perilous for a variety of reasons. One is the state in which the situation in which soldiers are kept, where they're starving. A lot of them come home sick. A lot of them come home maimed. But a lot of them also come home dead, even in peacetime. So women who have boy children in Russia spend the first 18 years of the child's life trying to figure out a way to keep the boy away from the draft.
How would they do that?
By either faking or even stimulating an illness.
And that would be enough to keep someone off the
draft? Well, it would have to be a pretty severe illness,
right.
Because they certainly have not been terribly selective. By hiding the boy, by shipping the boy abroad. I've done actually quite a bit of reporting on the different ways in which people dodge the draft, and there are some very creative ways of doing it.
Give us an example.
There are the sort of pat ones, like falsifying a psychiatric disability. There are different ways of hiding from the officer who comes to bring you your draft notice. There are people who go and literally camp in the woods for 3 months at a time while the draft drive is going on, and then their mothers cover for them.
Let me ask you about the TV journalist Vladislav Listayev.
Listayev, yeah.
Yeah, who was host of, I believe, two TV programs, one called Rush Hour and one called Viewpoint, oftentimes referred to as a kind of a Larry King, I guess, of Russia. He was murdered last week, I guess, at the entrance to his apartment house. What effect on the public? He apparently was a rather well-respected and even beloved figure.
He is one of the country's best-known journalists and probably one of the most popular people in the country. I think that this builds on the effect of the Chechen War in just making people lose hope. And this is one of the saddest things that have happened over the last few months, is that, you know, over 7 decades of Soviet rule, over tens of millions of victims of repression, people maintained hope. There was an opposition movement, and there was some hope that something could be done. And the scariest thing I'm seeing, especially among the people who were involved in the opposition movement, is the death of hope.
You were born in Moscow. You came to the United States in 1981 when you were about 14 years old to live with your parents who had emigrated here. You have recently repatriated. You're now back in Russia. What do you hope to be able to do as a journalist?
Well, I guess I'm going to contradict myself. I have not entirely lost hope. I don't exactly know where I get it. Maybe I get it from the 13 years I spent in this country. But I really hope that the pieces I write, and especially the pieces I write in the Western press, maybe they'll open somebody's eyes. Maybe they can make a difference. I don't know what else I can do as a human being. What I do best is write. So I'm writing as much as I can about the war and about the rise of the right wing in Russia and about what's happening in the country.
So. Well, we are out of time, and I thank you very much, Masha Gessen, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Masha Gessen has just edited and translated a collection of short stories by contemporary Russian women called Half a Revolution, published by Cleus Press in Pittsburgh. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Random House, publisher of Dreaming, Hard Luck and Good Times in America by Carolyn C. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
from Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet poet Lee Young Lee. His new memoir, The Winged Seed, is about his family's refugee experience and about the powerful presence of his father. Lee writes, "When I was a child, I prayed to God, but as a teen, I discovered I've been praying to my father." And rock critic Ken Tucker finds that some of the music in today's movies may be worth checking out. He reviews the soundtracks to Boys on the Side, The Jerky Boys, and Ready to Wear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House has announced that President Clinton will be visiting Haiti at the end of the month. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
A presidential trip to Haiti had been discussed and rejected in the past at the White House. Many of the president's aides used to feel the president should not be associated with a foreign policy venture that was so controversial. But with only one American casualty, the policy is now considered at least a moderate success. And the new thinking is it would be wrong for the president not to congratulate the American troops in Haiti. So the president will visit Haiti on March 31st. Just as the U.S. and allied forces will be turning over their peacekeeping mission to the United Nations. President Clinton will meet with President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to discuss economic, security, and political issues. His day-long trip will come at the end of a three-and-a-half-day-long swing through the South. The president will attend an economic conference in Atlanta on March 29th, then travel to Tallahassee, Florida, for a meeting with community leaders. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A House panel has approved a plan to radically alter the food stamp program. The House Agriculture Committee met into the early hours this morning. Members voted to cut projected spending on the program by at least 10% over the next 5 years. The committee approved a bill restricting cost of living adjustments in the program to 2% a year. The current system pegs increases to inflation. The panel also rejected an effort by some Republicans to include food stamps among the welfare programs that House GOP leaders want to turn over to the states. The Clinton administration says these cuts threaten the health of needy Americans. The French government said today a planned meeting of European members of the contact group on the former Yugoslavia has been canceled. The officials were to discuss ways to persuade Croatia not to expel UN forces at the end of the month. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
A foreign ministry official said the meeting did not take place for technical reasons. He refused to give any details. He said for the moment, no other meetings of the contact group are planned. Officials from France, the United States, Britain, Germany, and Russia are trying to strike a settlement with the help of Serbia, but so far, Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic has refused to cooperate. The contact group is also worried that the United Nations forces in Croatia will be forced to leave at the end of the month when their mandate runs out. Officials fear if those troops leave, the United Nations will have to withdraw its troops from Bosnia, increasing the possibility of war spreading throughout the Balkans. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Senate Republicans have decided to permit Oregon Republican Mark Hatfield to keep his post as chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Some Republican senators had challenged Hatfield because he was the only Republican senator who opposed the balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. That failed last week by one vote. On Wall Street, stock prices closed up today. The Dow gained more than 16 points to close at 3,979. This is NPR. China has narrowly avoided UN criticism of its human rights record. The UN Human Rights Commission voted 21-20 today to reject a resolution expressing concern about human rights in China. But even with the defeat, human rights groups considered the vote a victory. The BBC's Sophie Fisher has this report from Geneva.
For 5 years, Western countries have sponsored resolutions critical of China's human rights record. But until now, Beijing has lobbied enough support to defeat each one with a no-action motion. This means that no mention of the criticism appears in the UN's records. But this year, following an intense campaign by the United States and European countries, the resolution was forced through to a yes-no vote. This alone represents a major defeat for China, and the fact that Beijing only just avoided public censure is a serious loss of face. China's delegation has always portrayed attempts to censor its human rights performance as politically motivated attacks. American diplomats, however, dismiss this. They say that China's record is finally being judged in the same way as those of other states, and that this is a significant step towards showing that powerful countries are treated in the same way as small ones.
Sophie Fisher reporting. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton says the United States plans to spend $100 million on women's literacy in poor nations. Mrs. Clinton made the announcement today at the UN Poverty Summit in Denmark. She says the U.S. hopes to improve women's education in needy countries. The goal will be to increase literacy in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The government says the American workforce is getting more productive. The Labor Department says productivity rose 2.2% last year. The rise came along with the smallest increase in labor costs in 30 years. That category is a key measure of inflation. The productivity index is measured by comparing the output of American workers to the number of hours they put in. An increase means companies are churning out their goods more efficiently. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane. Poet Lee Young Lee uses his writing to make sense of his family's past. Both his parents were born into wealthy, politically connected families in China. His mother lived in a sprawling compound, waited on by a large staff of servants, including 30 seamstresses. His grandfather was the first elected president of China until he tried to make himself emperor and was thrown out. Lee's own father was the personal physician of Mao Zedong for 9 months before he fled the country with his family in the late 1950s. Lee Young Lee has written two books of poetry. In the foreword to his first book, Rose, the poet Gerald Stern wrote, "What characterizes Lee's poetry is a certain humility, a kind of cunning, a love of plain speech, a search for wisdom and understanding." Lee has just written a memoir called The Winged Seed, in which he tries to piece together the various strands of his family's history. He told me his parents have always been reluctant to talk about the past. He said he slowly learned that his mother's childhood had been privileged but constricted.
She talked about it later. When I was growing up, when I was much younger, she didn't talk about it at all. And I would, of course, sneak into family albums and find these pictures of all these, ladies with their hair done up in silks and standing there in the very posed scenes in public gardens. And they had a private zoo, and you know, they had pictures taken in the zoo. And I wanted to know who these people were. And she would tell me, "Well, this is actually the person you were named after, and this is your, you know." The third daughter of the eighth wife and so on. And it was very complex. It was a kind of complex hierarchy of all these relatives. And when I would bring them to her attention and ask her about them, she would at first, you know, talk about them with some enthusiasm, and then she would resist. It was almost as if she realized she was talking about something she really didn't want to get into, and she would resist. But later on... we've been able to talk about it more and more.
What about your father and the family he came from? Did they have the same wealth and status as your mother's family?
They did, you know, but his father was, well, I would have to say he was almost insane. My father's experience growing up was very different. His father kept his family in a kind of virtual poverty, even while he was becoming richer and wealthier and traveling. But he kept his children and his wife in a kind of dilapidated house outside of Beijing. And I talk about that in the book and how strange that was for my father.
Well, what happened then when the Communist Revolution swept through China? What happened to your parents' families?
Well, my father's father, who was very savvy, by that time had already purchased a lot of property in Indonesia and America. He had something going with the Bank of Rhode Island and so on, so it was very easy for him to leave the country. And because he had things set up in other countries. But he left his family, his children. And my mother's family stayed on, and they tried to work with the nationalists at first, you know, and then later on they tried to work with the communists, but eventually they lost their wealth, and they lost all their position, and even my great-grandfather's name was kind of mud by that time.
And is that when he took his family and went to Indonesia?
Right, right. He took his wife, my mother, and his daughter. But he left his oldest son there in China and didn't get him out until 26 years later.
Your father was arrested in Indonesia in 1959. What was his crime?
He was charged with working with the CIA to bomb military installations on the island of Java. But of course, it was all false. He was just a teacher. You know, he was teaching English and religious thought, Western religious thought and Eastern religious thought, a kind of comparative religion course at the Gamaliel University, which he helped found. And I think it was because of this leaning toward the West that got him in trouble. And, you know, the Sinophobia that swept through Indonesia at the time and is still very present there now was responsible for, all the Chinese being rounded up and locked up at that time.
He was sentenced to a leper colony. Was that an unusual punishment, or were many prisoners, criminals, sentenced to leper colonies?
No, a lot of them were. That wasn't unusual. I guess what was unusual was that he didn't get leprosy, you know.
Your father then was transferred from the leper colony to a mental hospital.
Right.
And it was there that he began to preach. Did he have some kind of religious or spiritual conversion while he was in prison?
He went to the mental hospital because my mother discovered that if he were at the mental hospital, she could visit him more. He nearly died when he was in prison, and they actually came to him while he was lying on his cot, and they asked him, well, what color suit would you like to be buried in, you know, brown or blue? And he had to make that decision, so he was that near death. And in fact, he didn't die, and he credits divine intervention for that. And his love for the Bible, his intellectual love for the Bible became a kind of, more than intellectual love, it became, an emotional attachment and spiritual belief, just faith.
Once your father then was finally released from the mental hospital, came home, your parents decided you really had to get out of Indonesia. You had to escape.
Mm-hmm.
How were they able to do that? How were they able to escape from a country where clearly he was a marked man to some degree?
Right. Well, he attributes that to divine intervention too. The details were he was being transferred from the prison system on Java to a prison system in Macau. And while the whole family was going to be transferred, and while we were on the boat to Macau, the boat was docked, not docked, but it was a few miles outside of Hong Kong. It had stopped and dropped anchor. And a smaller boat had pulled up beside it, and a man boarded our boat. And it turned out the man was an ex-student of my father's. He was looking for somebody who had chartered this smaller boat, and the man wasn't on board. So there he had this already chartered boat. It was empty. And my father asked him, well, do you think we could get on it and you could just take us to Hong Kong instead of that? That would be an escape. And he said, well, if you could get it past the guards. So my father took the chance, walked up to the guards and said, well, our boat is here and so on. And the guards looked through our passports, and through an oversight, they let us go. And we were on this boat on our way to Hong Kong, and that was how it went down.
Do you actually remember this?
That I don't remember. What I do remember, and I've always had this image, was looking out of a porthole window and seeing the Christmas tree, this huge green lights, a Christmas tree on the shore of Hong Kong. And that's what I remember.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a very short break, and my guest is the poet Lee Young Lee. He's just written a book about his family. It's a remembrance, as he says, and it's called The Winged Seed. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Here's Lee Young Lee reading from the opening of his memoir, The Winged Seed.
2 a.m., I wake to rain. Apartments dark where other travelers sleep. In my dream, my father came back, dressed in the clothes we'd buried him in, carrying a jar of blood in one hand, his suit pockets lined with black seeds. His gray wool suit seemed hardly worn, except for the shoulders and elbows, which were buffed smooth, I guessed, from rubbing against his narrow coffin. And then I saw his shoes. They were completely wrecked, their leathers cracked, nicked, creased, cross-creased, their puckered seams, where the stitching came unraveling, betrayed his naked feet. Sockless, his ankles were frightening, and only the thinnest soles kept him from walking in bare feet. I began to cry, realizing he walked the whole way. I thought of him climbing alone the hundreds of identical stairs up from his grave in Pennsylvania, and then, obeying some instinct, walking west to Chicago toward his wife, children, and grandchildren. When did he begin his journey? I wondered. In the dream, I felt ashamed, disturbed by the thought that while he looked for me, for us, his family, we were quite unaware of his arrival, which might have taken him years for all I knew, since no one ever told him where to find us. It hurt to think of him walking for years along the blind shoulders of highways, through fields, along rivers, down sidewalks of North American cities and villages, walking day and night, talking to no one, walking, a dead Chinese man separated from the family he'd brought to this country in 1964, a stranger to most when he was alive, an Asian come to a country at war with Asia, now a stranger in death. I kept looking at his shoes.
That's Lee Young Lee reading from the opening of his book, The Winged Seed. Your writing seems to be then a conversation with your father. You seem to keep conjuring him up, I guess. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's what your writing is about?
That might be what the subject of the writing is about, but I don't think that's what I'm up to when I'm writing, you know. I think what I'm trying to do is get to a place where I'm speaking with a virgin voice, a voice of complete disinterestedness and detachment, in order for me to hear something that isn't only personal to me. I really would like to hear, I would really like to speak straight from the soul. I think if I could do that, then the soul would no longer be in this realm of rumor for me that it is. The words would be an incarnation of the soul. And that's what I'm up to when I sit down to write, you know.
Well, you mentioned the fact that English is your second language, and your family, your father and mother brought the family to Western Pennsylvania when you mm-hmm. were very little. Mm-hmm. Your father was a preacher. I believe you were about 6 years old. Mm-hmm. What was it like at that age to settle down? I mean, there'd been a number of years of rootlessness and a number of years of real fear. What was it like to settle down in a strange American town?
Well, it was a violent experience, ultimately. You know, there are many, I think, small working-class towns throughout America that are very beautiful, but there's a kind of underlying violence in them that's expressed, I think, through like football, in the case where I grew up. But there's a kind of violence, I think, to assimilation in general, you know, the racism we encountered and things like that. But at the same time, my parents always told us that we were going back home. So the whole time I was living there, I always had the feeling, well, this is just another stop, you know, along the way. We're going home. It hasn't been until recently, I mean, like in the last 4 years, that it has suddenly dawned on me, I'm not going anywhere. This is home, you know.
Have you gone back to China?
Yes, I went to China about 4 years ago. It was then that I realized the idea that we're going home, it was just ridiculous. Because when I went to China, I realized, well, this isn't home. And when I went back to Indonesia, I realized, well, this isn't home either. So where was it my parents thought we were going back to, you know? And that was when I realized that America, North America, is my home.
So is America your home by process of elimination then?
You know, I might say this. Emotionally speaking, this doesn't even feel like my home. I feel as if there will be no home for me. Maybe it's not just me. Maybe it's everybody. I don't know.
Are you lonely?
I used to be intensely lonely. I'm not anymore. No, I'm not.
Do you know why?
I think it's because this idea that I grew up with about going back, I still carry it with me. But I realize that I'm going back now, that with every step I take, I'm going back. I'm going home.
Poet Lee Young Lee has written a memoir called The Winged Seed. This is Fresh Air. Joining us from Nashville is Linda Wertheimer, who is in Tennessee on special assignment. Linda, what stories on All Things Considered tonight?
Marty, we will have from Washington a reaction to the death of American officials in Pakistan. We'll be analyzing the fall of the dollar, and Elizabeth Arnold will be reporting on Senator Mark Hatfield and the pressure that he is under because of his vote on the budget amendment. And from Nashville, we'll be talking about barbecued ribs. We'll meet Miss Kitty Wells. We'll go to the vocal clinic where the country stars go. And we'll also talk about politics and why Tennessee went Republican.
Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Movie soundtracks have long been a commercial force in rock music, and never more so than now. Rock critic Ken Tucker has found that you don't have to have seen the movie to enjoy the album. In fact, sometimes you can enjoy the music more if you haven't seen the movie. Here's his review of the soundtracks for Jerky Boys, Ready to Wear, and Boys on the Side.
Boys on the Side is that female buddy movie starring Whoopi Goldberg, Drew Barrymore, and Mary Louise Parker, and its soundtrack album is filled with songs sung by women, including Bonnie Raitt, whom you just heard doing the Roy Orbison song You Got It, as well as tunes from Melissa Etheridge, Sheryl Crow, The Cranberries, The Pretenders, and Sarah McLachlan. The collection is a bit of a ripoff. Of its 13 cuts, there are three versions of You Got It, two by Raitt and one by Whoopi Goldberg that's the height of movie star indulgence. But I really like the left-field stuff it also includes, such as the Pretenders' version of a song by Morrissey, Every Day is Like Sunday.
Trudging slowly over wet sand, back to the bench where your clothes were stolen. This is the coastal town that they forgot to close down. Come, Armageddon, come.
Robert Altman's Ready to Wear is one of the most widely panned movies of the year, but its soundtrack album is selling nicely due to the fact that the film's fashion world subject matter requires kitschy hip music to match the dresses on display. It's already yielded a hit single, Here Comes the High Stepper by Eni Kamozi, but I like even more the reggae singer Supercat's new version of Fats Domino's My Girl Josephine.
I get it from my granddaddy, return home from the war. Josephine, Josephine, Josephine. Hello, Josephine.
The best of these soundtracks is from what is probably the worst movie here, The Jerky Boys. Although valuable seconds are wasted with snippets from The Jerky Boys' jerky prank phone calls, this disc is stuffed with good, loud rock and rap music. My favorite cut is L7's grungy take on the old Blondie song, Hanging on the Telephone.
I'm in a fumble, this a one of the law. If you don't answer, I just ring it up the wall. I know he's there, but it's out of call. So leave me hanging on the telephone. So leave me hanging on the telephone. I heard your mother, now she's going out the door. Did she go to work or just go to the store? All those things she said, I told you to ignore.
Because they're so uneven, soundtrack albums are a dicey purchase, but as these collections suggest, they're becoming good places to find new music and quirky covers by artists in a relaxed mood.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Today's show was directed by Alan Tu. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.